Everyone was so surprised that we had a bottle of rum on the boat, by the way.
Yeah.
They were like, you were drinking. I was like, it's the only way we got through.
Barely, barely drinking.
Yeah, I literally had like a sip every week.
And that was enough. The waves within the first 48 hours were probably like 30 foot. I think we kind of maybe expected to be eased in, but it was like, no, like, bam, this is what you're going to be up against.
Hi everyone, and welcome to a really special episode of the 80% Mental podcast. Now, you might remember that a few episodes ago, I spoke to Laura Langton and Kit Windsor, two of the four members of Team Ace of Blades, not long before they set off on their quest to row across the Atlantic. Along with the other two members of the crew, Liz Watson and Beth Motley, they set off from La Gomera in the Canary Islands on the 13th of December, and then, 47 days, 7 hours, and 27 minutes later, they rowed their 25-foot boat into English Harbour in Antigua, having successfully navigated all 3,000 miles of the world's toughest row. And now, after a couple of months back on land, I am absolutely thrilled to be joined by all four members of Team Ace of Blades. And not only that, but we're live. Well, we're not live. I'll edit it later. But we're in person in glorious Technicolor in London in the really quite nice Podshop studios in Shoreditch to talk about their incredible achievement and, of course, the role that psychology played on their adventure. How did they manage sleep deprivation, seasickness, and bits of the boat breaking? How did they cope with being away from friends and family for 7 weeks? Who did and didn't get hit in the face by a fish? We'll explore all of this and more on this episode of 80% Mental, but I'm going to get straight on with it because it's my absolute pleasure to introduce to you Laura Langton, Kit Windsor, Liz Watson, and Beth Motley. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Well, first of all, well done. Congratulations. That's an absolutely incredible achievement. You were saying earlier you've been back on land almost as long as...
Yeah, almost as long as we were at sea.
Yeah.
Which is a bit mad. Like, yeah, it's quite a bizarre feeling, that, I think.
It feels as though we've been home for a very long time. Life has just bounced back to normality very quickly. Yeah. And I thought it might take a little bit longer, which would have been nice to let things sort of settle in. But turns out normality just is, you know, is what it is. And what we did is sort of just a surreal dream.
Life continues.
Okay, well, we'll get into all of that stuff. And I want to explore kind of what it's been like being back. But I kind of want to start at the beginning, really. Laura, you're on the start line a couple of hours before the start. Like, what's going through your mind at that point? You're about to set off on a 7 week voyage. What are you thinking?
I think it's, so we had to have a safety briefing at 6 a.m. on the morning of the race, and we were setting off at 8:33 a.m. So we're there for a couple of hours before. There was a real feeling of camaraderie, and the whole fleet was sort of pulling together. We'd made such good friends for the 2 weeks before when we were in La Gomera. And it was sort of a bit of like a boiling pot, really, because normal life had gone. You know, I hadn't been at work for 2 weeks. I'd sort of briefly kept in touch, but not really. And then because the race start kept on changing, it was the 12th and then it dropped down to the 8th and then it was the 10th and then it was the 14th. Everybody was sort of struggling to come to terms with when are we actually going to go. And then, yeah, it felt surreal that we were actually on the start line. All of our friends and family were on the pontoon above, sort of looking down at us and kind of giving us sort of wry smiles. And I, you know, you could see that everybody was a little bit emotional. So many photos. And then, yeah, just as we were sort of pushing off, Fraser, one of the safety officers, was like, "Go on, girls, you've got this." And I thought, do you know what, we have? Like, we have really got this. And so I think that was like a real sort of, I don't know, an amazing feeling. And then just knowing it was just going to be us and we had no idea what we were going to come up against was incredible.
I very specifically remember going out of the harbour and just being like, what the F are we doing? Like, as we're going through the small boat channel. But I think, yeah, pretty much exactly what Laura says, like, it was we did it. We got to the start line, and everybody that we've spoken to in the build up to the row had said to us that getting to the start line was the hardest part, because you've got to raise all the funds, you've got to get the training hours in, you've got to fit your life around the row, essentially. So actually being there, I think there was a huge sense of achievement before we'd even set off. which was quite a nice like culmination of all the hard work that we'd put in.
It didn't help that people said, oh, you've raised all the money, so you don't even really need to do it now.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not quite the attitude we need.
And I felt quite a sense of relief as we kind of left the harbour. It was just kind of like, so this is it. Kind of like those 2 weeks, sort of that build up to that morning and leaving. And even the night before felt really overwrought, but kind of rowing out and you sort of watching people disappear. I was surprised that I didn't feel as emotional as I thought I would. It felt like you can breathe now and we've just got to deal with what we've got to deal with when we need to deal with it.
Mm. And Beth, what had you done to sort of mentally prepare for the trip?
Oh God, I don't know. I mean, I guess it just kind of, what had I done to mentally prepare for the trip? I mean, just tried to, my way of dealing with the row was just chunking it down. After those initial few days, kind of chunking everything down to 2 hours, like everything was in 2 hour slots pretty much, unless you rowed three up. So if you're rowing for 2 hours and you even broke that down into an hour. And so, rather than thinking about, oh, we've still got however many miles or however many days, just what's right in front of your nose, what's kind of like your moving average and focus on the next few minutes. Mm. That I, when shit hits the fan.
Yeah, you can swear.
I quote from Caitlin Moran. She says sometimes all you've got to do is get through the next minute, and it works quite well in quite a lot of different situations.
Liz, what about you? You're kind of on the start line, waiting to get going, knowing that you're not going to see friends and family for 6-7 weeks. What's going through your head?
As Laura had mentioned, we had the big sort of all fleet briefing, and it felt just hyper surreal to have had all of the previous 3 years like distilled into like that moment. Mm. And for me, I mean, we all knew what we were going to be doing at sea. We knew how every bit of that boat worked. Like, I knew we were going to be fine as soon as we sort of cast off. For me personally, I had this really big block, and that was sort of the final conversation with my partner before we went. I really got into a dark place about that. So for me, it was having like a final quick phone call with him back in the UK, because he didn't want to be there for the start and I didn't want him there. And then as soon as it was like, right, hang up, hand the phone to my mum, let's go. And then all of the sort of the fireworks start going off as the team start going, you're like, okay, this is it. Like, we got this. We know what we're doing.
Yeah. So almost kind of drawing a line under
that was
kind of
it.
What you're leaving behind and then focusing on what's coming up.
It felt very defined in my head.
Yeah. So I guess talk to me about the first few days then, because I guess you can prepare as much as you can prepare, but also you can't really prepare. So, I mean, Kate, what was the adjustment like in those first few days?
We lost sight of land within the first like 8 hours, I think, because it was so foggy. So I think that almost, I don't know, I think for me that helped, because it was like, right, okay, we've left and now we are in the middle of this ocean kind of thing. But I don't think any of us expected to be so violently seasick. Like, it was like, I've never been so sick in my whole life. Like, so violently. And during all the training, right, it's like Laura within our team, famously not good with bodily functions, like burps, farts, the lot. So, like,
nothing yeah. to be done in front of me. Like, I'm not a big fan.
So, like, when Laura threw up, we were like, okay, this is bad.
Like, the first to go spectacularly as well.
Yeah.
It was also one of the funniest moments. But you leant over the side of the boat, vomited, and then apologised to Barrett's for puking on their logo. And it just was a bright spark in what was otherwise a very dark 48 hours. Even you were laughing at yourself.
So we were all quite seasick. So we called Ian, who's the head safety officer, and we all took Studeron, I think that's what it's called, the seasickness tablets, and that sort of sorted us out. But I think a big thing for me, I was looking at the video diary that I took on the way over, and thinking back, actually, it's very true. Like, I really thought that sleep deprivation would be the thing that got me, but for the first week, I think we all did really struggled with food. Mm-hmm. And like the weather was just so big. Like the waves within the first like 48 hours were probably like 30 foot, which I don't think any of us had expected. I think we kind of maybe expected to be eased in, but it was like, no, like, bam, this is what you're going to be up against. So yeah, it was a shock to the system, but I think we all adapted really quickly and did really well with that. Yeah.
So Liz, what did you do to adapt really quickly to the, you know, the weather, the sickness?
Did I adapt quickly? Did you? The sickness, it was just medication was the only thing that was going to sort that out, to be honest. The waves, it felt really shocking for really like, yeah, that first couple of days. And then you learn that the boat just goes with it, and then it didn't feel quite so bad. Mm. The sleep pattern, we always knew I was going to take a couple of days to sleep at all, and I did, but you know, that was fine. But I think we all did really well actually just getting into the shift pattern. Like nobody was, you know, being late out on shift or anything. It was fine, and we all knew that we had to row three up for a while to be able to make some headway. And I think we were all there for each other, really. Like we were all quite literally in the same boat. everyone was scared of the massive waves, very wet from the rain, hungry but also feeling sick at the same time. We knew that we had to get that. Everyone has said that first week is the worst bit, and it's true. Almost actually all of it was quite hard, it turns out.
So I guess, you know, with the sleep patterns, tell me a little bit about the shift patterns, Beth. 2 hours on, 2 hours off?
2 hours on, 2 hours off. But in the 2 hours that you were on the oars, you rowed with two other people. So I'd swapped in. When I was rowing, Laura and Liz would be swapping in, which kind of broke it up quite nicely. Then you came off the oars and had 2 hours off, and it was kind of get yourself cleaned down. I mean, I think the observation we all made quite early on, and it sounds utterly ridiculous, is the Atlantic is really salty. Is it more salty than other oceans? I don't know, but it just felt as if it was. So kind of clean yourself down, try and get something down you, whether it was kind of liquid or food to get some calories into you. And then sort of give yourself sort of, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes, half an hour tops, and then and try and get some sleep. And getting into that routine was really important because... yeah, just to get the sleep and just to get everything done so you could try and get your eyes closed. At least even if you weren't sleeping, just close your eyes and lie down.
Mm. And like, what's the impact there? Because obviously your sleep pattern's changing quite dramatically, like quite suddenly as well. Like what impact does that have on sort of your mental state, the way that you're thinking about things?
I know that I was quite confused, waking up being quite confused as to where I was and what I needed to do, and kind of like, oh, do I need to get dressed? What do I need to do? What's the time? Because you don't want to let... I didn't want to let Kit down because I was swapping in and out with Kit. And any time that you waste or if you're late, that means that they're on the oars for extra time, and then, you know, and their rest period gets shortened. But yeah, I think it was mainly confusion. I'm going to say the words, I didn't feel tired. And but that wasn't,
I would disagree with that.
That wasn't the overriding feeling. It was kind of like that confusion that goes with kind of like being woken up abruptly and sort of just feeling really disorientated. So yeah. Yes, I was tired, but that wasn't the overriding kind of feeling.
Laura, were there ever any moments of like doubt? You know, those first couple of days when the weather's hitting you, the sickness is hitting you. Was there any moments of, it's not that far back if we turn around now.
I think what's really funny is that everybody else in this room seems to have forgotten some key issues we had for the first few days.
Come on, then.
So we didn't get into our shift pattern 2 hours on, 2 hours off.
For at least a week.
Yeah, we didn't actually do that for that amount of time. So we did the first 17 or 18 hours, we did three ups. We did 2 hours on, 40 minutes off. Mm-hmm. And then the waves basically became so big that we, our auto tiller basically wouldn't work. So every time that we were trying to maintain a steady course, it would just keep jumping off. So we then locked off our steering for about 24 hours and didn't make any progress. We were just, it wasn't working for whatever reason, it wasn't holding. So then the next day, we decided that we were going to hand steer for at least 12 hours, but ended up doing it for 24 hours. So our shift pattern was 2 hours on, an hour hand steering, an hour rest.
So what does hand steering involve?
So it involves, because we didn't have any gloves, which I would is a top tip for all rowing teams to take with
them. Take some gardening gloves.
But your gloves didn't really work very well.
My gloves wouldn't have fitted anyone else.
So, so basically, the steering line is like two, I don't know, thinner than a dog lead line that's holding the rudder in place, which is, I don't know, maybe half a door panel size. And then that's being hit by quite significant waves. So you're holding probably about 40 kilos worth of force going through these tiny bits of rope, trying to maintain a course where you've got no point of reference. So all you can do is just hope that it works. So during the day, it's pretty horrendous. And then at night, we were sort of like, right, Orion's belt is just over, like, just to the right of there. I think we're kind of going in the right direction.
And then it was remembering that the stars move as the night goes on.
The Big Dipper would arrive and you're like, oh, where have you come from? And where should you be? But then it would be incredibly cold. So you'd just be sat there. And so two people would be rowing, you'd be hand steering. And I remember Beth was just sort of like, I've never done this before.
I was like, I really panicked.
I was like, yeah, really none of us have done this before.
It was like, I was terrified I was going to put us in the wrong direction, that we'd be going back.
But then Liz would turn around to me and go, yeah, can you tell Beth that none of us have done this? Because she's zigzagging everywhere and we really need to keep... And then basically, so that was day four. And then day five, we managed to get the auto tiller on, but it would only stay on if somebody held it on. So during the day, we did 2 hours on, one hour holding the auto tiller, 1 hour rest. And during the day, the cabins could get up to about 40 degrees because it was so hot. Mm. So you'd be sat in there with the door closed, just sweating, and just go, this is the worst.
And then trying not to fall asleep as well.
Trying not to fall asleep because it's so, yeah. And then overnight, we have to give her dues. Liz said, do you know what? I'll take one for the team and I'll sit and hold the auto tiller on for the 12 hours of nighttime. And then it meant that we rode 2 hours on, 1 hour off between the rest of the three of us.
Yeah.
So we refer to it as the auto gremlin times, where you would open the cabin door and Liz would just be there sort of in her sweaty box.
Eyes like Ren and Stimpy. Oh, like.
And then there was one time that happened two nights in a row. So Liz was allowed to leave her box when the daylight broke. And the waves were, I've said this before, but they were like three-story townhouses coming towards us. So then Kit and I, sort of most experienced rowers, so we swapped around our shift pattern so that Beth and Liz could follow us, and so that they would be sat in the seat behind us rather than in the front. Because you didn't necessarily row all the time, because you put the oar in and then you'd just be booted off the seat, which happened many times. And I think that first week we had bruises all down our sides. Yeah, like it was horrendous. We were sideswiped the whole time.
Yeah.
I do like the fact that you've all like got this out of your memory.
No, it is still firmly in my memory.
Yeah, I remember.
And then, yeah, so then we did that. And then eventually we managed to get the auto tiller to stay on by having an elastic band tied around it and some sticky tape.
But high-tech.
Yeah, so it was, yeah, the first week we didn't get into any sense of routine at all.
It was almost a celebration when we actually did manage to get into the two on two off, because we were like, oh my goodness, more than like 40 minutes sleep at a time, or like,
it's like a real life where I can actually have time off. Yeah. I can sit and do nothing rather than have to do something to make sure we're going in the right direction.
Yeah,
it felt as if it didn't get light for that first week, as if it was always dark as well. It was just like
one of my favourite things was when we were sat there.
Says a lot about the psychology. The sun didn't rise.
And I think it was Kit, and she was like, it doesn't get light until 8 a.m. It's now 4 a.m. We've got four more hours of darkness. I was like, it's fine. It's only four more hours. It's not a problem. And in my head, I was like, oh, please come on, sun. Come get here.
And you'd see a wave come and it would block out the stars. You're like, oh, this is going to be a problem.
But you could only see one wave in the dark. In the daylight, you could see a lot
all
more.
Of them,
it was just kind of like, just dealing with the one in front of you. Was, I think.
Yeah.
My favourite one was shouting when people holding on the auto tiller, you'd shout, there's a big one. Because then it was like, make sure you're definitely holding it on. Because otherwise, if it came off, the boat would breach. So it'd like spin on its side and it would take quite a long time to try and get it back around again. And it was quite frustrating. And so there were times though when during the day you'd just shout every sort of 10 seconds, there's another big one. You're like, maybe we should just say when there's a small one. That would be less conversation.
The opposite, like, okay, now if you need to itch your face, do it now.
There was one time, though, which I found hilarious, when I was shouting to Liz. It was middle of the night, and I was shouting to Liz about something, and she didn't answer, and Beth sat behind me, and she went, I thought she was meant to be holding the auto tuner on. I was like, well, she's probably fallen asleep. I was like, maybe we should let her have like 30 seconds of closed eyes.
Please.
Anyway, that's what she gets.
But it was great, like coming out of my auto gremlin status. I'd been so unused to like the big waves. It was really terrifying. And I just remember sat down and went, oh, guys, these are really big. And it was like, fine, don't worry about it. But then it was like, we definitely had a different, like, I can't remember, it was definitely you and one of you preferred rowing at night because you couldn't see what was coming.
Right.
Where I found that much worse. Like, I'd rather in the day be able to predict, but yeah.
Yeah, because I, when we were doing the training rows, I really didn't enjoy rowing at night, and there were some dolphins one night, and I was like, Laura, there's something in the water. And she's like, yeah, there's a lot of things in the water. And I was like,
maybe we should just get this out there straight.
Let's establish
okay?
just now.
There's going to be a lot of stuff in the water. There's going to be some weird noises. We'll probably just have to go with it, okay? Just the terror, the terror in your voice.
Yeah, I was really scared. I don't know why. But I thought I would be really scared of rowing at night, but actually I preferred it because, exactly as Beth said, you couldn't see the waves that were coming. So I was like, this is fine. And then as soon as the sun started coming up, you're like, oh my goodness, it's fine. We've done that all night. Oh, it's fine.
This I think that fine. Was the, that was the sort of surprise by it, though, is just how relentless it was. Mm. Because, you know, the ocean didn't care what time it was or whether or not you'd been doing it for 24 hours or 2 weeks. It was just never ending massive waves. And you just then you're like, oh, I could just really do with just mooring up somewhere for like less than 10 minutes just to hold stuff in place, regroup myself and keep going. But instead you're like, right, I put my pot of food down there and it's spilt everywhere. So that's great. And there was just... You just thought that you were going to get some respite. And definitely for that first week, we had absolutely none. And I think that was a really defining moment for all of us because, I mean, we get given flags when we leave. So there's flags on the flagpole. And somebody posted a picture of theirs from last year. And they're like slightly frayed on the corners and, you know, looks like they're a bit weathered. Ours were literally ripped to shreds where you
we had half a Union Jack left, didn't
like,
we?
It was just ridiculous. And that just shows you how like battered we got for 7 weeks. But I think also that sort of meant that we had way more experiences than we would have done if we'd have just sort of headed south and picked up the trade winds and then been pushed along.
Trade winds don't exist, by the way.
But flying fish
they do.
This is the 80% Mental Podcast, and I'm here with Laura Langton, Kit Windsor, Liz Watson, and Beth Motley from Team Ace of Blades. You've just been talking about that first week, and it sounds relentless. But I guess I'm kind of interested in how the personalities and relationships between the four of you developed over the course of that. Obviously, you did a lot of preparation together. Liz, can you tell me a little bit about that, about the sort of relationships between the four of you, whose personalities came out? Did you learn anything new about anybody else?
Did I learn anything new? No, I don't think I did. I think, in terms of how everyone would respond emotionally to different things, I feel like we kind of had that pretty down. We sort of realised that actually no one had just had a hug for a really long time. So sometimes you would just ask for a hug, and Kit has a really big wingspan and gives really, really good hugs. I felt like we were all very tired and easily emotional, I think, quite quickly. I definitely felt very paranoid for a while that I was the most emotional because I would just cry whether I was happy or sad. And then you could see that like Laura was skipper for a reason because she was fine. Always fine. But I think we all sort of zigzagged about around like being the stoical one for different people when they needed it. Like, I think, you know, now and again, you'd come on shift having a really hard time and I was there being like, we got this, Kit, don't you worry. You sit there, you need a chocolate bar. And then maybe two shifts later, I would be sobbing my heart out and having a hug from Kit. I think we were able to switch it up for when we needed it. And I think that was really nice.
So what was everybody's roles then on the boat? So Laura, you were skipper, unflappable.
Is that... I wasn't unflappable in terms of emotion, because I definitely think that I was more emotional than I had intended to be. Hmm. Not that I had any intention to not be. But I think that in terms of confidence with what we were facing and making decisions, that's why I was skipper, because it was very much, you know, this has happened, how are we going to resolve it? And then I think it's fair to say that I basically just was like, looked at everybody, we had a quick chat, and then I would make the decision on what we were doing. There were times when it was, the weather's good, let's row three up, or the weather's bad, let's row three up, which I think Kit didn't like the most, maybe.
Just sleep-wise, it was more just like the, I think mentally for me, it was the like, once I start doing something, I'm fine, but it was just the like, oh, it means less sleep. But then, like, once we were doing it, it was definitely.
And knowing
fun.
You weren't going to get a 2-hour sleep for up to about 36 hours. Because that was sort of the longest that we did three up for, which it was brutal. But it, especially towards the end, it was necessary because there was big weather fronts coming in. And the teams that came in after us were delayed by sort of quite a few days because they were being pushed back by wind. So I think it was necessary. And then Kit was sort of fix it, bitch. So along with Liz, and the just sort of anything that happened was like, okay, we need to sort this out where it's...
And because it was a day ending in Y, that was most days.
I think the water maker will always be just the icing on the cake. I mean, we lost our dagger board within the first week and Kit was in the water cleaning the bottom of the boat. She was like, just pull the dagger board up a second. And it's meant to be about a metre and a half long. And it was, I don't know, like a 20
centimetre... It was flush with the boat.
Yeah, 20 centimetre stump.
With a jagged edge.
And the safety officer, Ian, was like, have you got anything left of it? Because it would definitely, you know, help. And we were like, it's basically just like a centimetre. He was like, oh, that will still help. It definitely didn't. And then it was like, oh, is there anything that you could use instead of a dagger board? And we were like, well, only our chopping board that holds our gas canister in place, but we like that.
There's lots of bits of the boat breaking and lots of things going wrong.
Yeah.
I think in hindsight, we were, now it seems really obvious to say, but we were the fourth crossing for the boat, but the boat's 10 years old. And that meant that a lot of the components on the boat are also 10 years old. Mm. Yeah, we should have bought a second dagger board because our dagger board was 10 years old, but
it
we didn't know that.
Only thing we didn't have a spare of as well. Like, which was
nonsense.
Yeah.
We're there just singing. Oh, like, anybody said, oh, what do you want for Christmas? Just a dagger board. Just, if anybody could give me a dagger board. And we'd have these, like, we had these tiny little Christmas presents given to us by Kit's sister and family and also Liz's husband. And I was like, do you reckon there's a dagger board in there?
Did anyone else have two dagger boards? No one had two dagger boards.
I don't think so.
Because, of course, you spent Christmas and New Year on the boat as well. Yeah. Beth, tell me about that. What was that like, spending Christmas?
I mean, it just was another day. We did sort of take a break and took some footage and opened presents and had Christmas hats.
Yeah.
And it was just another day. I mean, I'm the eldest of the crew by quite some margin. I have two kids. Christmas is always a bit of a chore, and I've been saying for years, want to be away for Christmas. Like, this is what happens, people, when you don't organise a holiday at Christmas. I set off across the Atlantic. So it wasn't something that really bothered me, not being at home for Christmas and New Year. But I know that you guys didn't see it as necessarily as black and white as I did.
I thought I would be fine because I find Christmas quite stressful because I've got a very big, loud family and just want a bit of peace. but I had, like, knowing that everyone was together, I think I definitely, like, had, like, a bit of FOMO, like, missing my partner and my family and things like that. But, I was quite surprised by that because I think I've always been a bit like, COVID Christmas was perfect because it was, like, quiet, but you still, like, talk to each other and, like, we had a big family Zoom and things like that. So, it kind of made me realise that maybe I'm not quite as much of a Scrooge as I thought I was.
You definitely realise how isolated you are out there. Yeah. When big things like that are happening, it's like the only time I spoke to my mum on the phone was on Christmas Day, because we sort of decided that we weren't going to have like lots and lots of conversations. And you then realise actually that immediacy of communication that you have if you're anywhere else in the world. You know, if you'd gone away for Christmas, you could still text people and FaceTime and everything else, but we didn't have any of that. So then all of a sudden being like, oh, they're all having a lovely time. And but lots of people since then have said to me that, you know, they'd go to bed and they'd be like, oh, Laura's still rowing.
I'm yeah.
Like, yep, that's exactly what... But you just, you know, you had a job to do out there, and that's what your focus was. So I think that's what really helped me, was just say, there is no other way we're going to get there apart from rowing this boat to Antigua. So we might as well just put everything to one side and just crack on.
And of course, it wasn't just you four on the boat, was it? Because you had some visitors during the trip.
Yep.
Did anybody not get hit in the face with a flying fish?
I didn't get hit in
the
face. No, I got a direct chest hit, and I got one in my lap, but I didn't get a direct face hit.
The direct face hit is not the one you want.
Yeah, they hurt.
And also as well, like when I got hit in the face, I think I was the
first to get hit.
So I had a headband on. And
oh, no, I think I was the first one. It got me on the side of the head, and it took us all by surprise.
Oh, that
had never happened.
Yeah.
And we were like, what was that? But it wasn't Laura's headband hit, to be fair.
Well, then I think it was like middle of the night, and we'd just seen a whale come up, and you could just about see it.
You and I were on
shift, and it was really beautiful. I think Liz had just, I was just swapping with Liz, and it was amazing. And then like maybe 5 minutes later, I was on the oars and just got absolutely smacked in the head by a flying fish, which really hurt. And I thought, oh, that's going to bruise. That's not the one. And I was quite brutal because I thought that they were a myth. I didn't realise that they actually had wings, and that their wingspan was pretty impressive, and that they were about 40 centimetres long when you got sort of the big ones. And then you try and pick one up to throw it over the side because you didn't want it to die, and it would just flap away at you. And you're like, right, we'll die then because I can't help you.
And they stink.
They really stink. And then the one that hit me landed in the middle of the boat, and I was like, no, I'm not stopping rowing. You can just die. That's fine. But then the next morning, I like must have just gone to sleep and then woken up and like took my headband off. And I was like, what the hell is this on the side of my headband? And Liz, I was in the cabin. I was talking to Liz, and Liz was like, oh, maybe it's just like the label or something. It looks a bit weird. And I smelt it, and I was like, oh, my God, this is fish scales. And literally the force of the fish they basically left their
imprinted
their whole body of fish scales on me. And I was just like, this is ridiculous. And I think there was quite a lot of that. I mean,
they shed their scales really easily. Like, they're very delicate. I mean, to illustrate that, when we had already got to Antigua, my husband went into our cabin. He like went head first in to try and get my trainers out from the depths. And he came up, and he'd only been in there for 15 seconds, and he had a fish scale stuck to his forehead. They were just all over the place.
But they were also, I mean, they had pinpoint accuracy. The first time this happened was we could hear something flapping around, and it was the first time a fish had landed near me, and I was not having any of it. And like, I got up, and Kit was like, okay, I'll try and find it. And I was like, moving my seat, I was like, where the hell is it?
You could hear it, couldn't we?
And you could hear it really flapping around. And then basically this inside the seat is hollow, and there's a very small slit where you could go in. And the fish had gone through that and landed inside the seat. So I was rowing with a fish inside the seat, which was just ridiculous. And then the pinpoint accuracy was proven the second time when it went down Beth's top. And it also, Beth had got to the point where she was so delirious that if I told her what to do, she just did it. And then she asked for permission to stop rowing. And I was like, I was ironically going, no, you can't stop rowing. So she just kept rowing. I was like, this is hilarious.
I mean, the thing is, I had like a sailing jacket on. It was zipped right up, and sailing trousers with a bib. And it went down the zip, which was kind of like up around my face, and down the bib. And it was in my pants. And it was flapping around.
Which we got all on camera.
Because basically, we got to the point where nobody was really that like fussed by it anymore. And it was trying to get as much content as we physically could. Because one time, I was meant to be coming on shift, and a fish landed in the middle of the boat. And instead of getting out to help, I just opened the cabin door and videoed Liz trying to get it.
And then just went, back in again.
But yeah, the fish down the top was a pretty good one.
It was a moment.
That was, I had just settled down for a sleep in the cabin and I heard this shrieking stuff. And I just mastered the sleep anyway. Yeah. And I just lay on my side and was like, a little grin on my face. Like, that's great.
It doesn't affect me.
I'm not going to help.
It's one of those moments when you scream because it's not pleasant, but at the same time, laughing so hard as well because of Laura pissing herself. And it is just kind of, this is ridiculous. The fucking fish down my pants.
We got so fed up with the flight because it was ridiculous. Like it was really odd. Like in the daytime, you could see flocks of them, and I think they flock. You see loads of them just going over the surface of the water, and then but never ever on the boat in the daytime. And then at nighttime, they'd be like, "Oh yeah, yeah," coming at you from all directions. So I messaged my husband. I was like, "Can you Google for me? Because I can't. Are they attracted to light?" And he went, "Yes. Green and white light, which are two of the colours on the nav light that we turn on at night." So after that, Laura was like, "We will row in darkness forever."
I was like, I mean, we've got two options. We've got flying fish coming and ruining the boat and hitting us and making life
unpleasant. And stopping us rowing
and smelling and just being revolting. Or we can just be in the darkness and look at the lovely moon.
Always there because the moon rise changes all the time, so then it had the knock-on effect for me, who did not like rowing at night. I'd be there for 4 hours or increasing amounts of time being like, "When's the moon coming?"
the best thing ever about the moon is that it just has a mind of its own. The moon does not care what's going on, because there was times when it was like 1 p.m. and the sun would be at its highest and the moon would just be loitering. And we're like, "What are you doing here? You're meant to be here at night time and you're not here at night time and you're here during the day."
I was going to say, you know, flying fish aside, just being out there in nature, sunsets, the sunrises. I know you posted a lot of videos of sunsets and sunrises. And I remember that Laura and Kit in the previous episode, we talked a lot about almost that sense of smallness, like that scale when you're sort of out there, you know, in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. Astronauts often talk about this thing called the overview effect, where they leave you, they see the Earth from a different perspective, and it kind of changes how they feel about it. And I just wondered, again, being out there in nature, like, did anybody kind of get that sense of a sort of perspective shift?
I think there was one day towards the end when it was the day we went on power anchor. We'd been hand steering for like 15 hours. We'd gone absolutely nowhere. It was absolutely brutal. But I can remember you and I just, you turned and pointed to Laura. Laura and I were having a conversation and you went, "This is awful, but it is also absolutely stunning." Like it was
you couldn't deny that at all.
Brutal, but like there was beauty within that brutality as well, so that was quite a like defining moment, I guess.
I think also all of us at different points just realised that it was a real privilege to be out there. You know, it's not a given that you, just because you sign up doesn't mean that you necessarily get to start. And just because you start doesn't necessarily mean that you get to finish, which was highlighted with a really sad passing of Alistair Putt from one of the, from the Aussie Old Sorts, another crew.
Yeah.
But even when it was at its most horrendous and we were all sat there thinking, "This is the worst," I think you just looked out. And I remember that moment completely because the waves were going in completely the wrong direction for us. And I had I had real latitude sensitivity and anxiety, which is basically we were going way too far south and just being pushed. And we were facing west, but we were going south. And I was like, "This is the worst day ever," especially with Kit going every 45 minutes, "We've rowed 200 yards." I was like, "Yay, that's fantastic. That's the spirit." But you'd be sat there and you'd be thinking, "How are we going to get through this?" We were just sat there in what should have been one of the worst experiences for us, but witnessing just the most incredible like series of Mother Nature. I mean, you're there with three other amazing women and realizing that nobody else is experiencing what you're experiencing at that exact time, and that you've, like, all four of us together are doing something that nobody else is doing at that time. You know, everybody else, there's other boats out there, but they're not experiencing what we're experiencing. So I think that was definitely a sort of perspective change that I think was really helpful for all of us, because you could have easily thought, this is horrendous, we hate it, or like not enjoying it, but actually taking a step back and thinking, do you know what, this is absolutely amazing. And I think that's definitely something that I miss, is being that little bit removed from normal life where you can just actually go, well, there's nothing else I can do apart from just be here and sort of revel in the like amazing experiences that we're having. And yeah, okay, it's horrendous, but let's all just laugh about it and row 200 yards in 45 minutes.
Then maybe cry a bit and then laugh again.
I like feeling like, I don't think you get it very often on this planet that you feel like a guest somewhere, but there was sort of, you just had to go with whatever it was throwing at you, and that was that. And I mean I probably will never feel like that again, because it's always like, oh, how can I make this bit of land more convenient and work better for me? Like, that is not an option in the middle of the ocean. Like, no, it's not, you don't have a say at all. So that was, looking back, not as fun at the time, definitely a type 2 feeling. The other sort of bit that really stands out to me was when the first whale we saw, and Beth had really wanted to see it. We all did, but Beth was especially keen to see a whale. And it was at night. We just sort of saw it really slowly come up, and it did its spurt, and then it went under and did another one. And then Beth just said that she found it really comforting knowing it was there. And like, that is true. Like, there was something really comforting about this massive whale in this middle of nowhere underneath you. It was a really lovely moment, I think.
And also the sky at night was just something that was so special, kind of like when it was clear and you could see the Milky Way, and you could see it made you dizzy, and you're never going to be able to see the sky like that away from light pollution. And it just kind of made you feel so small, just not even just you as an individual, but just kind of, you know, the earth in context of where it sits. It, you just felt tiny, and it was breathtaking. I can't think of a better way to describe it, but it was amazing. I think that was possibly, as well as the whale, but I think that was the most special feeling, that kind of like, whoa, we're just dots, nothing.
And also when somebody turned around and said, you know, none of those stars are still there. I was like, crikey, this is all just
too much. Just as you're hallucinating from sleep deprivation.
This is, you're about to get off the boat and try and go get a mango. I'm like, oh, I'm thinking, yeah, maybe don't do that, Liz. But no, I think it was, those were just, yeah, there was a lot of stuff. I think Beth and I rode together, and there was a shooting star that went from the left-hand side of the sky to the right-hand side and left this long trail of gold dust. And knowing that, you know, loads of other people might have seen it, but in that one moment, just Beth and I had witnessed it. And we looked at, like, I turned around and I was like, did you just see that? She's like, yeah, it was incredible.
Yeah.
I'm like, now get back, Rowan.
God damn you.
So this is the 80% Mental podcast, and I'm here with Team Ace of Blades. We've been talking about their first week, bits of the boat breaking, being hit in the face with fish, and just the beauty of being out there in nature. I want to ask you, each of you really, what was the toughest moment, Kit, for you? What was the toughest part of it all?
I think the being away from people was really hard, and I think because there's no ripcord to be like, okay, I've had enough, come and get me now. So that was tough. But I think the toughest moment was the day we went on para anchor, because the day before, I think we'd like gone 3 up, we'd had like a great time. We were like, oh, if it's like this for the rest of the way, like Antigua's in touching distance. We did like 70 miles, I think, that day. And then the next day, like, we literally like came off from being 3 up to it being really, really tough all of a sudden. And it was that sort of the come down from the elation of being like, Antigua's in touching distance, we'll be there in like X amount of days if we keep going this pace. And then to being doing 200 yards in 45 minutes and being like, what's happened?
So para anchor, that's the thing that stops you from going
backwards, so you put the para anchor out when the wind's blowing you in the wrong direction. On that day, the wind and the current were going in completely contradicting directions, and the waves were going in a third direction. So our poor little boat was like I don't know where I'm supposed to be going. So, yeah, I'm like, we were absolutely exhausted. And I think we all at varying times had a bit of a like, like, are we ever going to get there kind of thing. So that, I think that was really tough. Yeah, sort of that. Yeah, like the come down from being on such a high of having such a great day, I think, was, yeah, particularly tough.
Laura, what was the some of the tough moments for you?
So I definitely agree with Kit. The day 30, which will be forever etched in my brain as the day of power anchor, was by far the toughest day, because it had come, like, we'd come to a realization that after 15 hours of 2 hours rowing, 1 hour hand steering, 1 hour rest, the sheer sort of strength that you needed to hold on to the rudder was just ridiculous, and it was horrendous. After 15 hours of that, I was internally thinking, okay, we just need to get through another 6 hours, but then looking around at the rest of the crew and just going, like, we just don't have this, like, we need to do something else. And I think the realization that actually you can't always get through it, like, there came, I had to really reframe it in my head that it wasn't failure putting the power anchor out, because so it's like a big parachute that you put out and it holds your position as best as you can do. We probably would have dropped south about 15 miles, I think, but we dropped down about 3 because of the power anchor. But that was then a decision where we were going, right, okay, we're not going to row. We're just going to sit and wait until this weather passes. Whereas I'd hoped that we'd be able to get across without using it. And it was, I think you called Fraser, the safety officer, to begin with, and then Liz called. And then there was sort of a murmuring about it. And Kit was like, maybe you should call him, because I just wasn't comfortable with the idea of giving up, which is how it felt in my head.
Yeah.
And then I spoke to him on the phone and he said, you're not giving up. It's not failure using this. Like, you've got a tool on the boat that will help you to get through a situation that you're in. Why wouldn't you use it? It's a sort of tactical decision, because none of us had eaten for 15 hours. We just had sort of liquid fuel, which, as much as it was good to get down and like it was calories on board, it wasn't anywhere near as good as having the carbohydrate and everything else that you get from a proper meal. None of us had slept. Like, we were all just in a really low headspace. And so he was saying, look, this is like, putting the power anchor out is going to give you 6 to 8 hours of respite where you can fuel yourself, get some rest, and be ready to go when the weather passes. And no matter how strong you think you are, you're not stronger than Mother Nature. And I was like, oh God, this is a real, like, it's, I'm a massive control freak, which is just the way I am. But I was thinking, I'd always thought whatever hits us, we'll be able to get through it. And so for me, that was like admitting defeat, but then also at the same point, realizing that that's not actually what it is. And I've definitely taken that back with me through like my actual life and thinking, do you know what? You've got these tools at your disposal. Just because you think path A is the way to go doesn't necessarily mean that B, C or D isn't a better option. So that was a particularly dark day for me. And then a close second was when the water started tasting a bit weird. And Kit gave me her water bottle and she said, oh, do you think this still tastes as nice as it did before? And I took a sip of it and I was like, thinking, just say it tastes nice. Just say it tastes nice. And then that opened up a whole episode of basically us realizing that we'd been drinking salty, soapy water, which turned out to be rust that we'd been like cooking our food with and having everything else. So I think that was like another turning point where I was like, oh, here comes another bit of issue where we're going to have to deal with it, and it's going to stop us from rowing, and we may not be able to resolve it, and it's going to be like another episode of what else can go wrong on SS1.
Yeah. Were there any moments of like, well, I hesitate to use the word panic, but were there any moments of like, oh, this is actually a really big deal here?
The water maker. I think that, like, realizing we were potentially going to have to hand pump water for
like 3 weeks.
3 weeks,
it?
Yeah. And so the electric water maker makes 40 liters of water without any interference from a person within an hour. And the handheld water maker makes 3 to 4 liters in an hour.
Not even that.
And you have, well, we gave it a good go,
yeah.
I think also as well, when the line got caught around the rudder, that was another situation where, I mean, it doesn't paint me in a great light, but we had, it was sort of midnight and the boat, we were going along merrily, weren't we? And then it was like somebody put a handbrake on and the boat just span.
And we were trying to turn it around, and you were in, Liz was in the cabin trying to turn it and saying there was no, it just wasn't going anywhere.
I was trying to move the rudder around.
I was trying to move it with my hands.
Yeah. We were trying, like, there was a lot of, there's something really wrong here.
Yeah.
And then we just had a bit of a conversation whilst trying to row, but the waves were coming over the top of the boat because we were like beam onto them. So we were in a bit of a pickle in that sense. And Kit turned around to me and was like, I think if I could probably just get in the water and just check and see what's happened.
It was pitch black.
Pitch black, yeah. Like, and I said,
it wasn't calm sea either.
Yeah, it was horrendous sea.
It was dicey. It was, to say the least.
And I looked at her and I was like, are you an idiot? I was like, there is absolutely no way you are getting in this water. Like, I'm skipper. That's your safety. You're not going in the water. Like, really, I was quite angry that you suggested you were going to do it. So then I called the safety officer and said, this is what's happened. Do you know what the reasoning would be behind this? And he was like, it sounds like something's caught behind the rudder. You know, if you can just like drop the rudder slightly, it might just loosen it. But, you know, there is the risk that you then not lose the rudder completely, but you lose the central position of the rudder. He was like, but you've got your dagger board, so you'll still have stability. I'm like, no, Ian, we don't have a dagger board. So then it came to sort of, we had a bit of a further conversation with him, and he was like, well, you know, your only option really is just to wait until daylight for somebody to get into the water, because that, like, then you can work out what's happened. And then Kit was like, we're not sitting here for 8 hours. I'll just get in the water. I was like, yeah, actually, if we've got to sit here for 8 hours, maybe you should get in the water. So that then started a whole episode of working out whether or not it was the right idea to send one of our crewmates into the dark depths underneath so that we could just keep going.
So we basically decided that if Ian said I could go in, I'd go in. So I just tied in a wind. Yeah, two ropes on my harness. And I was literally in the water for like 30 seconds.
Oh, yeah.
And then like we had like the million candle power torches like shining on us. And then merrily on our way we went.
Yeah. So that was only about 45 minutes of dismay rather than
8 hours of...
But yeah, that was another one where I was a bit like, okay, this... Like, as a crew, we are sitting here getting absolutely battered. And I don't think there was ever any panic, though. I never felt like there was anything that we couldn't deal with. It just was potentially going to either extend our time at sea or just mean that one person was going to be rowing whilst we try and resolve something, like trying to open the filter housing on the water maker.
Yeah, was really, like, so the water maker's got two filters. It's got like a mesh filter that takes out all the big stuff, and then it's got a micro filter, which sort of is like a nano filtration, I think it's described as. But it was a brand new unit and it was like factory tight, so I couldn't get it undone. And so like, I was like, Laura, please can you just make sure I'm not being like a puny little weakling? And it took us nearly an hour to get it off, didn't it?
And you did like the biggest She-Hulk saying to us,
roar. The roar was amazing.
But isn't meant to be in a negative way, but we were speaking to a lovely gentleman on the phone who was explaining to us what we needed to do. And I said, it feels like it's glued on. He goes, oh, I wouldn't be glued on. He's like, just remember, it's lefty loosey, righty tighty. And I was like,
which was quite helpful in like a lot of the time, because like when you're that tired, you're like, right, righty tighty, lefty loosey.
We'd be good on. And I was there and I was like,
yes, sir.
I think that filter housing was probably about 5 seconds away from being smashed.
Yeah, it was definitely
just, like that relief when it actually came undone. And then we found an orange filter which should have been white. That was a horrendous time afterwards. Yeah.
But it was like, just give it some little taps with the hammer. We were like, we'll give you some little taps.
Beth, what about you? Dark moments. Difficult moments.
I think the first few days, kind of when that realisation that we've left, we've got a long way to go, and sort of those dark nights and the big waves, and I remember thinking, oh, I don't want to be here. Like, I tell you what, Beth, you have spent the last 15 months putting in a fair amount of effort to put yourself right here in this very spot. But that fear, that was when... just that gut-wrenching fear, kind of those first few days, and sort of and feeling so sick as well, and just not being able to sort of, your body was retching and you couldn't control it. And I think Kit's words to me were, this process is going to strip us all bare. I'm trying to think of something different to say other than the power anchor, but yeah. the the hours that led up to the powering, because to seeing that seascape, which was utterly kind of brutal but beautiful at the same time, and that exhaustion, because I think I just had nothing. We were 30 days in, did you say?
Day 30.
And it was hot, yeah, as well, and the sun was coming down, and it just felt kind of like, is this ever gonna end? We've gone nowhere. And just that feeling of being so small, and you know, you're at the mercy of an ocean, you know, it takes no prisoners. That was quite a, I know that Laura had the hard decision of kind of determining whether we were going to go on power anchor or not, but that feeling of like, what are we going to do? Kind of, is this it? That was, yeah, it's terrifying.
Liz, what about you?
I think it was a series of worst moments, but all the same thing. And it was kind of started with the power anchor, but it was, so you had the power anchor and obviously all of the heartache of having to go on that. But then the elation of actually you've all had a really good rest and now you're able to move on, you're making really good progress. And then finding out from people on land how much it had affected your finishing time and day, mm, and how much time it had added on. And every single time, like for whatever reason, something, it was out of our control, like how fast we were able to progress really with the weather. But every time a day was added on or 4 hours, I was crushed. I let it get into my head a lot more than I should have done. Mm-hmm. Because actually now I've done it, if I could go back and tell day 31 me, don't worry, like it doesn't matter if it's an extra day, like you're still finishing it and no one cares, that would have been great. But it really got into my head, and it felt like every time someone told us that it was, oh, now it's this time, you would sort of die a bit on the inside. And it was really hard because you'd have people like your partners or whatever being like, it's only 4 hours. And you just like be like, I cannot tell you like how much we feel every one of those hours. So yeah, that was hard. And I think it made that final bit like more emotionally bad than it actually should have been. I should have really taken a step back and been way more firmer with myself. Be like, no, like just get that out of your head now. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And I tried, but it didn't really work.
So moving on to that final bit then, I watched, there's a video on YouTube, and I'll put a link to it in the episode description, of you guys kind of coming into the finish, the last bit. And I got quite emotional watching it. And I think it's just sort of watching a group of people do something so amazingly spectacular that they've put so much effort into, and that sort of release of actually finishing. Talk me through the last few hours, last few miles.
I think our finish epitomised the whole of our journey, if I'm honest with you.
I'm getting a sense this isn't as romantic as I'm...
to be honest with you, it was...
We came the
most,
in
it was,
time,
it was the most romantic... Like I think it's really weird because there was a lot of things that happened across the road that just felt like a really like beautiful situation to be in, when it was horrendous, but it was also like really romantic, like hand steering by the stars, the hand steering horrendous, but doing it by the stars, which was so beautiful, like fantastic. So that kind of was like the hand in hand emotions of our row. But then we basically sort of were told that by 20 miles out, people start looking at you with binoculars. So make sure that you are A, dressed, and B, not using the toilet. So we'd sort of got ourselves prepared.
We'd washed our hair the day before.
Yeah, we were ready. This is amazing. We like had a finishing outfit that Liz had designed that looked really cool. And everybody sort of had like an hour and 20 to get, or like an hour or so to get themselves ready. We were rowing three up. And then we were coming in and we were chasing down another crew, the Tide Wave. So we were for about 4 days, we were neck and neck with them, and then we would overtake them and they would overtake us, so that was fine. And then it must have been about, I don't know, like 6 hours away from the finish, it just absolutely chucked it down. Like I was sat in the cabin having a whale of a time.
I think it was squall, like, yeah, it was a nightmare.
Yeah,
it was you could see Antigua over your shoulder. And we're in the squall, and it's just like, I'm just trapped in an infernal nightmare, and I'm never going to step around again. That I genuinely
Beth
that
at
that,
one point that's was all in tears.
I was just like, this is like, it, like there's people there. They can probably see us. There's people there, and we're never gonna get there. I genuinely, that thought process went through my head, and I couldn't get it out. It just felt like we're just stuck. We're just trapped.
I can remember Liz was like, "That's coming for us," and I was like, "Positive mental attitude, PMA. We're gonna be fine. No, it's gonna scooch
you
over us."
See, you know, if you look out at the sea and you can see the massive columns of rain shifting. Mm. You could see loads of them at any one time. It was like being a Twister or something, because they're like, "Oh, that one's missing us, great." And then I was like, "We're gonna get really wet." And Kit's like, "Don't worry."
You were really like, cheering.
Okay.
I would say that my favourite thing was that I was like putting everybody before me. I was like, "You will go get ready. I'll be the last one. Don't worry." Like, we got to like 16 miles from land, and I was like, "Kit, are you almost ready? Because I'm still naked, so I can really do with if there's anybody stood at the top of Shirley Heights with their binoculars, they're gonna be having a real eyeful. So let's just sort this out." And then you take it like a little bit longer than you should have done, and yeah. I was like, "Oh, okay, you need to hurry up." And then I got into the cabin to get changed, and then the storm came in, and there's a video of me, and I'm just chatting because, like, for all the content stuff. I'm like, "Yeah, I feel really bad, but also pretty good that I'm dry, actually." And then that passed, and we were like coming really close into land, and then the waves crashing up against the side of Antigua was incredible. Like, is it like the igneous layers or
the
something?
The rock strata, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
That's just beautiful.
And it's like a sheer cliff face going into English Harbour as well, isn't it? So, and like the wind was like pushing us against it. So that was like pretty cool, but also a little bit terrifying.
Well, because the media boat was meant to come out and meet you, but because they had just taken the tide waves in, they were sort of a bit delayed. And then they came, we were just rowing across, and we were told that don't be scared that you're close to land, because it seems really weird and you should just stay on this bearing and you'll be fine. So everybody was like, "Oh, it's a bit close to land, Laura." And I'm like, "Yeah."
And Ian was like, "Your bearing is perfect." Yeah. So we were like, "Crack on."
Yeah, we'll just keep with this bearing. We're
a bit nervous.
You can't ignore perfect. That's fine. Anyway, we were just like coming in, and like we're probably about 20 meters away from the side of Antigua. And I was like, "Well, this is a bit close." But they did say you need to be close to land. And the media boat comes out of English Harbour, is like heading off, and then sort of looks left and sees us and does a handbrake turn. They're like, "You need to get away from the rocks." And I was like, "Oh my God, we almost just like, just totaled our boat like 100 metres away from the finish." But then definitely those last 200 metres, we were like rowing three up, really strong, like powerful, heading into the finish. And then when those fireworks went off and you could just hear the roar from the fort where everybody was, and then
I think
having a hug, the flares, yeah. That was just beautiful.
I
and
think
then that kind of fizzy pop, which was
yeah,
just
fizzy
delightful.
Pop was actually delicious. I think as well, because we came in with the tide waves, and we had a massive cohort of people go out to meet us, and they had a lot of people as well. We were told that we wouldn't be able to hear anybody on the fort as we were coming in, but oh boy, could
oh,
we!
Yeah.
Like they were like they Ian. Said that it was the most people they've ever had up at the fort as people are coming in. So I think it was really special us being able to hear everybody as well. Like, but yeah, they've.
And Liz was steering us in, which I would like the look on your face when you could see everybody.
Oh, it was because you come around, as you come in close to land, not that close, close to land. And then you've got the media boat, and they're telling you, like, okay, you need to head to that headland and then go, you know, to port a bit and then head for that buoy. So all you can see is like this buoy, and you're like, okay, fine, I'm heading to that. And then steered us around this corner, and it just went from rough to this idyllic Caribbean bay. And I was just like, oh my God, it's beautiful. It was it was absolutely incredible, and I sort of wished I could just turn you all around. Like, guys, look at it.
We were too busy rowing.
Yeah,
really
they were doing things, and I was like, I think it's really uncomfortable to hand steer. There's nowhere really to stand where you can get any good purchase. So I was like, my hands hurt, my feet hurt, just a little 100 meters to go. And then we stopped, and they gave us some fizzy pop, and then a pelican flew over our boat, and I was just like, where are we?
So then stepping on land then, you know, 47 days at sea, stepping onto land, like, what was that like, Beth?
Well, I mean, it was the fact that we all managed to get out of the boat, we all stepped out of the boat together, and the fact that we didn't all end up flat on our faces on that pontoon is probably a minor miracle. But it was amazing. All those people there as well, it was quite overwhelming having
all of those people, because the tide waves were there, as because they just come in sort of minutes before us, and realizing that your legs weren't where you thought they were, and it was just incredibly overwhelming in a good way, but also kind of there's cameras, there's microphones, just the emotion that you felt, kind of like there's a degree of fear, but there's also kind of like just being so pleased to see your family as well.
What was the fear about? What was the fear of?
I might cry. I lost my son before the row. So it was that fear that everyone else is going back to normal, and I'm so sorry.
Beth's son suddenly passed away 2 weeks before we left. And that was a massive defining and thing for all of us, wasn't it?
And it was just that shit. I'm stepping back onto dry land, and I really want to be here because my daughter was there, my son's girlfriend was there, my mum was there, but at the same time, you know, everything goes back to normal, and it's not going to go back to normal because it's never going to go back to normal. So that's I was maybe unique in having that kind of fear.
Very unique.
It's not something that we've talked about a lot.
Well, we talked about it a lot, I think also as well that it's it was a very personal thing to us as a crew, that we were there for Beth to support her through what it was. And we were also very aware of the fact that we were going back to our normals, and, you know, the rest of us don't have children, so we have no way of knowing how Beth feels. And I would never want to put myself in your shoes. But knowing as well that also when you get off that boat, I think there was that realization that when you get off that boat, you've got a hell of a lot more to deal with rather than just you're rowing whatever miles you can through during that day. You've got all the other people that have, you know, that expect things from you and that want you to react in certain ways that you haven't had to think about before. Like, to turn it into a bit more of a sort of positive thing for us.
Yeah, sorry to bring it down.
No, it was not at all.
But at the same time, it was just kind of like, whoa. Actually, you know, probably the last words you'd use about rowing across the Atlantic and spending 47 days at sea being battered and bruised, you were kind of in this cocoon. And I knew when I stepped on that boat and left La Gomera that when I stepped off, I knew that I was deferring grief. And I knew that because you have a lot of time to think. You're by yourself. When someone dies, what you realise is that you're not allowed to grieve. You've got to manage everyone else's grief, and having to go back to that, because I'd been quite privileged as well by having that space and time. So it was just quite that fearful process of having to.
There's also no expectations I think people expect you. I mean, expected Beth to behave in a certain way because they, you know, they were parents, and if they'd have lost their child, that's how they'd have reacted. And I think that you didn't have. There was none of that expectation on the boat. It was like a sort of solace where actually we have no requirements for you to be a certain way or not be a certain way. And I think as a crew, we were very much like, okay, I'm sad today. Well, then cry, and nobody's going to judge you for crying. Or if you're like,
if you need to speak your mind, say and whatever you need to say. And
it was very much like, just, you know, just do what you need to do, because between the four of us, there's A, no judgment, and B, no one cares how, like, you know, we just want you to do what you need to do. And there was times when, you know, Liz would go, I feel like I'm the most emotional on the boat. And Kit would say she's the most naked on the boat. And then it would be a competition.
That was probably correct.
But it was just that sort of thing where when it was just the four of us together, you know, I could turn around and say, right, you're not eating enough food. You're being a dick. I need you to sort yourself up. Because if you're not eating and not sleeping, then we've got a problem. And there was no other expectations of you other than just to do those things that meant that we could get the boat from La Gomera to Antigua, and that was it. And then you step on land, and all of a sudden, because I was talking to my mum a couple of days ago, we were talking about when we were unpacking the boat, and seriously, there was about 50 people there that were asking questions, and we were just looking at each other like, oh, I haven't had to answer any questions for a long time. People like, what do you want to do with this? I don't know, whatever you want.
Put it over there. We're going to pick
like, there's no system here. We're like, yeah, because you've come and got involved, okay? Like, we just need some time.
We had a system.
I think that was a massive thing, is that, you know, for almost 7 weeks. And actually, for the 2 weeks before we left, before family came out on the Friday, we'd basically just been the four of us tinkering around, doing our thing, like knowing what we were doing, knew what we was what was expected from us. And then all of a sudden you step on onto land and it's like a whole new world of people you haven't really embraced, and like you don't know what they've been going through, and they've all been told stuff that you didn't necessarily know about when you were on the boat. And you know, like, you're then reintegrating yourself into polite society, to steal Beth's words. But you know, it's just really like the things that were normal out on the boat just maybe slightly frowned upon in normal society.
We just quite long. The boat was frowned upon in normal society.
Well, it's because often people who spend a lot of time in the wilderness, when they come back, they do talk about that adjustment to real life. But also, it's been described as like almost like the smell of civilization.
Mm. Yeah,
I wonder what.
It was just using the word smell. So we saw a yacht on the crossing, and we sort of radioed them to say, "No, she's a rainbow, you know, limited maneuverability, stay with it. We're coming to see you." And I smelt that yacht. I could smell oranges and aftershave as it came up beside us, and kind of that just completely random. But at sea, you don't really smell much apart from flying fish scales when they. There's not much to smell.
Yeah. They were on a boat where you needed aftershave. That was not our kind of thing.
Although, do you remember when I put some deodorant on and Kit thought she was having a stroke? She was like, "Oh, there is a weird smell on the boat." I was like, "Oh, I just put some deodorant on." She was like, "Oh God, I thought I was dying."
But yeah, so you smell it. You smell Antigua as you were.
Yeah, the land.
That you could coming
you
in.
Really smell the land. Yeah. You could smell that difference in air as well as you were coming in, and everything smelled. If I hadn't known better, I thought I had morning sickness. Just everything smelled.
So you're listening to the 80% Mental podcast, and I'm here with Laura Langton, Kit Windsor, Liz Watson, and Beth Motley from Team Ace of Blades. I hope you've been enjoying what you've been listening to, which is a terrible sentence. But you can listen and subscribe on our website, 80%mental.com. You can find us on Twitter at EPM Podcast or on Instagram at 80% Mental. We're coming towards the end of the time that we've got, and I've just got a couple more questions, if that's okay. You've probably been asked this a million times. Plans to do anything else or never get in a boat ever again? Okay.
I'm a river rower anyway, and I am honestly just waiting until I build my glutes up again so that I'm not just sat on my sit bones to get back into a boat. I ocean rowing boat, maybe like for a poodle or if anybody wants a hand, but I don't think I don't want to spend that much time away from home again. So I might just stick to like river rowing, maybe the odd adventure here and there with my partner. But yeah, that's sort of, I think maybe it for now.
I think that nobody realizes how much of your life you have to put into this. I mean, we all went into it really very quite naive to do it. And I think that it's the most amazing challenge that we've done. But I don't think I've got that time or energy that I could put into something again in that sense. Like it was incredible, but also possibly the most selfish thing that I've ever done. Because especially, you know, for my fiance James, he went through the whole journey with me. He felt the highs and the lows when we were out on the water, because I'd like do a voice note or write a text and then we wouldn't have any signal and then they'd all be sent at the same time. So he'd read these roller coasters or listen to these roller coasters of my life, which he was listening to and dealing with and having to wonder if I was okay at that exact moment. But he doesn't get the glory of saying that he's rowed across the Atlantic Ocean. So I think I've done my one selfish thing for... hopefully for the foreseeable, although I did it when I turned 30, so maybe when I turn 40 I'll do the Pacific or something, and then Indian when I'm 50. You'll hate to hear me say that, so I promise I won't. But I think like I love the idea of challenges and pushing yourself, but things that only take maybe a weekend.
Yeah. Beth, what about you? Pacific next?
Well, I think when we got interviewed on the podium, I said never say never, and because I came to the team late,
I kind of always felt, because I stepped in because someone dropped out, so I only had a 15-month run at it, as right. opposed to, was it three years?
Yeah.
And I kind of feel that it was really intense and in at the deep end. I would do it again. With space and time between what we've just done and starting that whole process from the beginning where you guys started, but I would do it again. Maybe not as a four, because it was a really special four, kind of like, you know, there's a lot of emotional and mental baggage which comes with this row that I did with you know, Liz and Laura and Kit, which I wouldn't want to try and replicate. But I love the ocean. I surf, paddleboard. I like water. Yeah. I'm not river rower, probably the weakest rower on the boat, and I'd like another crack at it, I think.
Okay.
Ask me in 5 years' time.
Liz?
If someone said, I need someone to join our team, we've got all of the money, we've got the boat, yeah, I'd do it again. I don't want to dedicate 3 years to something like that, unless it was like my actual job. You know, like it took everything.
Yeah.
But I'm definitely eyeing up some other. I like putting myself through the ringers physically. So, I'm eyeing up the Yukon 1000, but with my husband. So that's great. Then you can train together and you don't feel guilty.
One of your fears, again, in the previous episode with Laura and Kit, one of your fears that you talked about was kind of falling out as a group and sort of going your separate ways and disappearing off afterwards. I'm sensing that the relationship between the four of you is strengthened rather than gotten more strained. Tell me a little bit about that.
I think the work we did as a team before we left really made sure that we wouldn't fall out. And also we kind of had an agreement that if we say anything to each other during the row, it's not out of spite or anything. It's kind of like you need to be your best self, and right now you're not being your best self kind of thing. So, yeah, I think we did really well in all acknowledging that. And we're all grown-ups and we kind of held each other accountable to behave like that. Like, there were moments where I think I probably let myself slip a little bit, but then we held each other accountable for it. So, I think that really helped. Throughout the row, if we're ever having a tough day, it was like we are still going to finish this as four friends. And I think someone said to you, Laura, before, like, nothing's worth falling out about, and I think we really held on to that, and that was, yeah, I'm really proud of us for doing that.
I think also as well, the many times, like, we had the safety briefings every morning before we went for 2 weeks. And there was one time, there was quite a lot of things that stood out to me in those safety briefings, but one of them was when Ian, the head safety officer, said, you know, if somebody says to you, you need to do this, they're saying it because they're trying to save your life, not because they're having a go at you. Mm-hmm. And so I think we took that with us as well. So it's like, name and shame Liz, but she would not have her harness on all the time.
Oh, yeah. Forget.
And then she'd like forget to clip on. And I'd be like, you need to clip on, because if you're not clipped onto the boat and there's a rogue wave and you're gone. I mean, that was seen when I tried to throw my shorts into the cabin and they flew off, never to be seen again.
That was a really sad day.
It's a really sad day.
Had like a proper curve on it, that throw as well.
I was trying my hardest to get it in the cabin, they'd gone, and I was like, right, pick yourself back up, those are your favourite shorts. But I just think that we'd all sort of agreed that actually, you know, none of us are there to try and have a go at each other. You know, I think I had like a tough love spell with each person individually, where I was like, right, I'm going to put my teacher voice on and be like quite aggressive towards you now, but you've asked for it, so here we go. And I think that I'd always said, right, that's what I'm going to do, because especially as skipper, I was like, nobody else is going to tell you that you're being a dick, so we need to sort this out. And then everybody just took that on the chin, and we all just knew that we were trying to raise the standard of the boat rather than like try and attack each other. And I think somebody says, oh, like, you know, human nature is to like pick on one person, like, and the weakest person, then it becomes like a bit of a Lord of the Flies situation. And I was just so adamant that that wasn't going to happen, that we weren't just going to be like every other crew. And we'd heard some really horrible horror stories of people falling out and never speaking again. And yeah, there were really tough times, and there's things that, you know, maybe if we went back, we'd do it slightly differently. But at that time and at that moment, that's what we were facing, and that's how we had to deal with it. And I think we all just rallied with each other rather than like saw it as a point of weakness. So
I think we tried really hard beforehand to make sure that didn't happen, and I'm really, really chuffed that it didn't.
47 days at sea in a 25-foot boat. How has the trip changed you? How are you different to when you first set off, Liz?
Well, so far, don't really find as many things like as inconvenient, I'd say. Like, I've had wet feet since I walked to the station this morning. I don't mind. That's okay. It's been worse. my sleeping, which we were discussing before, has improved exponentially. Try and wake me up with an alarm now. But I feel like things don't bother me as much because I've got something that was extremely uncomfortable and inconvenient to compare it to. So sort of, I don't know, just little things I keep being like, it's not as bad as that. No, that's fine. Like,
bit of perspective.
Yeah, I'm sort of finding that quite useful, actually.
Beth?
I spoke at a conference last week and I was quite nervous about it, but I found myself kind of going, it's going to be literally 30 minutes on a stage. How difficult can that be? And then was asked afterwards if I'd speak at another conference on a panel and to chair it. I've never chaired an event before. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure I can do that. I was like, hang on a minute. I mean, I've just got to ask some questions. How difficult can it be? So just that kind of like, do you know what? I mean, I wouldn't say it out loud, but your head just goes, you've just rowed the Atlantic. Come on, grow some and just get on with it. And it's just, which is kind of quite a nice thing to fall back on when you can feel yourself kind of like backing away from something that actually is going to be beneficial. It's not a horrendous thing. Yeah, there's benefits to doing it. It's kind of, come on, get a grip, woman.
Laura.
I think that like there was loads of defining moments out there, and I think that I learned a lot about myself in terms of being emotional, like how I dealt with things under pressure. I was like quite chuffed with, like quite proud of myself in some instances, and then other times I was like, actually, if I could go back, I would change my reaction to that, and I'd have prepared slightly differently for it. So I think that not just the positive side of things, but like the mistakes that I think I personally made have helped me to realize actually that's how you do things differently, and especially in the sort of leadership role as well. I think you just don't know you don't know what you don't know, and then you're out there and you go, oh, okay, nope, that's not how this works. But I think that's, and you know, putting yourself under such an immense amount of strain and then knowing that you can get through that is amazing, and that your body is capable of whatever you ask it to do is definitely, the mental side of things was much, much, much harder than the physical side of things. I think though that like, there's just so much like I kind of felt like I'd had like a wasting disease whilst I was out there as well, because people think that you're going to come back ripped and that you're really strong, and it's like your body's just been eating itself whilst you're out there. So you're like, right, mentally, I'm like, let's go and do this. Let's try and go for a run or do like back on land, and then your body's like, no, that's a no from me. So I think like, realizing how tough you are mentally and that your body will just do what you ask it to do is like an epiphany, really.
Yeah. Kate, what about you?
I think that I think completely agree with Laura. I think coming back, I've really struggled, particularly for the first few weeks, with like my brain was going at 100 miles an hour because the row occupied so much time before, but your body is just so not used to, or your body, you physically cannot do, you can't go to the gym as you did before because your body's basically wasted away. So I think post row for me, it's been trying to learn to like just sit with that a little bit and just actually sit still, which still struggle with a little bit, very much so, sitting still, not great at that. But I think definitely like perspective and also how you deal with things in a situation. And I think probably a bit like Laura, there'd be things that I would maybe prepared differently for or would like to have had a bit more knowledge about something, but until you're in it, you don't know what's facing you. And then it's actually realizing that you are wholly capable of dealing with situation X, Y, and Z and getting an outcome, whether it was the one you wanted or the one you got kind of thing, and accepting that that is that's what you get in kind of thing.
So just really quickly then, final question. And you've mentioned a couple of things already. We'll kind of go back down the line here. What's something that's just seared into your memory forever from this trip?
It's not like a overridingly, like, it's like it's a time of day for me. It's the colour of the water as the sun sets, where it's like completely golden, and on the top, on the surface, of like the deep hues of blue underneath, like that is like that color is just absolutely seared into my brain. And I genuinely don't know if I will ever see that again, because it was just stunning. And it's quite a like calming sort of thing that's in my, like, that is like in my memory now. That's kind of like almost like a mind altering, will I ever see that again? Because it was just it was just beautiful kind of thing. I think like the sheer beauty of Mother Nature is probably what's actually seared into my brain a bit.
Yeah. Laura?
It's really tough because you have sort of Kit saying something really beautiful and like incredible, and then there's just so many, I mean, there's so many memories that are either hilarious, like terrible, or like absolutely fascinating. I mean, we had like my speaker died on the first day, and then we had one speaker to sort of see us through, and then that died a death about 2 weeks out. But there was a time when we were all having a really tough time, and Proud Mary came on the on the speaker, and it was just like most ridiculous, like everybody was just having a lovely time all at once, like singing, and then Kung Fu Fighting came on, and I was asleep, and I just heard Liz and Beth absolutely cackle their heads off because Beth's daughter had put it on the playlist for us, and we were like, this is just nonsense. And then there was like when Liz had to do a naked run down the boat, that was one of my favourite things, because I thought she was like trying to put a top on, but she was putting a harness on, and she just ran down.
It was an emergency. No time.
I just think that there was
in the
just,
red light as well.
Yeah, just like, I remember when we had the music on, and we realised that the head torch could do like a rave with like red and green lights.
And so
we
just like, boys.
tried to give Liz a...
We'd found this playlist. Someone has taken the time on Spotify to put together the Now playlist, and it is every single Now, like all of the songs all of it. And it is like hundreds of days long. Yeah. And there was just a little moment where it went from like 5, 6, 7, 8, and then into the cha-cha slide. And these two were their blooming rave things. We're just middle of the night. And I was like, I'm off to bed. Bye, have a great time.
There's just so many of those euphoric moments. I think that you can't, like for me, I just, there is the beautiful side of things, but boiling it down just to the team thing, I think we just had ridiculous times.
Sublime to the ridiculous.
Yeah.
Beth, what about you? What's something that sort of seared into your memory?
I mean, probably a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B, that sky at night and just feeling so small, and just like your perspective and your place in the world, that is something that I'll take away and have forever. And like Kit said, probably never see again unless I happen to do another row and I'm in the middle of the ocean. But then those moments that just lifted you, kind of, and I know I've said it before, but for some reason, Laura being sick over the side of the boat was I mean, and not because I was wishing ill on her, but just it was, and you made light of it, and it was just funny when, I mean, it was, shit was going down. We were suddenly kind of recognizing, hang on a minute, we're not just going to catch a trade wind and row into Antigua. This is actually going to be quite hard. And Laura Langton being sick, having never ever been sick, just like, we are screwed. Kind of like, and it was just funny. And yeah, just those moments that when Eliza, my daughter, made a mum's row playlist, and
it was fantastic.
And it was a pretty good playlist, but out of nowhere, Kung Fu Fighting, and Liz and I just laughing.
It's like, how does she even know what that is?
Yeah, I mean, I think she was just going add. Yeah, it was just little things like that that lifted you.
Liz, what about you?
I've got two things. One's a silly one, but I think it, for me, just epitomises being chucked around by the sea. And that was, we were in quite a big squall. The safety officer had said, no, there's no point in rowing. So we were like, we'll just ride this out then. And you would try to take a stroke and it was like the sea was concrete. It would just spit you out again. And I was with Kit. And I was hallucinating quite badly anyway because I was sleep deprived. But I was still rowing or trying. And then I tried. And I don't know how it happened, but I somersaulted backwards off my seat and ended up half in the little sort of the drainage channel, but with my head in the poo bucket, which was clean.
With her legs in the air.
And I just was like, how did I get here? And just was laughing so hard I couldn't get up. But it was just stupid. And Kit was just like, what happened? I don't know.
But the best thing about that was when I then came out and half an hour later and Liz went in. And I said to Kit, I was like, should I try to row? And Kit was like, yes, I think you should. And basically the exact same thing happened to me. And Kit was just laughing her head off. I was like, oh, cheers then. And I just got absolutely through. She was like, yes, well, that serves you right.
What was the other one?
But then for me, I think the one thing I keep going back to, and I have mentioned it already, is the moment we steered around that corner into the bay. And not because it was over or anything, but it was just like, this is the moment that all of these years of preparations, like this is what it came to, that, and it couldn't be more beautiful, like if we tried. And that felt really special. Then another school came in. So, you know, bring us back down to earth. But yeah, that for me, fuzzy feelings.
Awesome. Well, I think that's probably as good a place as any to bring things to a close. So I just want to, first of all, thank you all so much for making the trip to do this live in person. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. So thank you to Kit Windsor.
Thank you very much.
Laura Langton.
Thank you.
Beth Motley.
Thank you.
And Liz Watson.
Thanks for having us.
You've been Team Ace of Blades. I've been me. This has been the 80% Mental Podcast. An extremely high quality episode of the 80% Mental podcast. You can listen to all of the other extremely high quality episodes at 80%mental.com, where you can subscribe. You can leave a comment there as well. Or you can follow us on Twitter at EPM Podcast, on Instagram at 80% Mental. But leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Tell everyone how amazing we are, how brilliant we are. And yeah, I hope you've enjoyed what you've been listening to today. And we'll see you next time. We won't see you though. it's a podcast.
I feel like I should clap.